reasons why people live in poverty. It's because of structural systemic injustices.
Hey, I'm Drew Dudley, author of the bestseller, This Is Day One, A Practical Guide to Leadership That Matters, and you're listening to The Ed Show.
Welcome to The Ed Show, a podcast where I sit with some amazing personalities from across sectors and borders to have meaningful conversation on topics that matter to us.
Welcome back. Today, I have two very special guests on the show. My first guest is someone who has been a catalyst of change, a man with a vision, whose efforts on eradicating poverty and SDGs has been well recognized worldwide. He is someone who has worked across continents and has been instrumental in mobilizing political and public support for SDGs in association with many celebrities and public figures, including Rihanna, Beyonce, Usher, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, Prime Minister Emma Solberg, and more, and has been instrumental in publishing his thoughts in top publications around the world. He is a well-known personality with many laurels, a board member for Ban Ki-moon Center for Global Citizens, and co-founder and chief policy and government relations officer with Global Citizens. He is Michael Sheldrick. And our next guest is a well-known sociologist and a grassroots activist for human rights, health, and equality, and is the director of global policy and government affairs and leads Global Citizen Education and Sustainability Portfolio. She is Talia Fried. Hi, Mick and Talia. Welcome on the show.
Yeah,
thank you really for having us. Hello.
Thank you for having us.
Mick, can you please throw some light on how the poverty is creating a misbalance in this society? And what will be the outcomes if we'll not work towards reducing inequality?
Yeah, so, you know, really, up until this year, folks used to say that one of the greatest success stories of the modern era was the eradication of poverty. You know, certainly from when I was born in the late 80s, until just over a year ago, you know, we used to talk about how poverty had been reduced by more than half and how we were on track to become the first poverty-free generation, you know, in human history. And the fact that this had never been done before, you know, you had always had degrees of extreme poverty. Whereas now, of course, in the last 12 months, because of COVID and really because of its aftershocks, you know, it's estimated that 150 million people will be pushed back into poverty by the end of next year. And this is going to set us back by at least 3 years and make the goal that all countries signed up to end extreme poverty by 2030, the Sustainable Development Goals, all countries signed up. But it's going to make that exceptionally hard to achieve by 2030. And so we've got our work cut out. And then, of course, you know, that's just extreme poverty. So we're talking about the poorest of the poor, you know, those that earn less than US$90, you know, per day, you know, those who have to make decisions often, do I have a meal on the table or can I send my kids to school or can I put some aside for healthcare? You know, often they don't have enough to do all of those things. So they've got to make trade-off about, you know, just the basics that perhaps you and I and Talia and people like us would take for granted. So, you know, that's just extreme poverty. But then you look at economic inequality more broadly, and you're seeing in all countries, including wealthy countries like the United States. And of course, you know, to some extent, COVID-19 has exacerbated and exposed many of these inequalities. But you're seeing record-breaking levels of economic inequality. In some societies, you know, you haven't seen this degree of inequality since before the First World War, right? And so this is not just inequality between, but within societies. And what it means is you have this really absurd scenario where, you know, a few folks in our society have actually seen their wealth soar over the 12 months. You know, you've seen the number of billionaires and their collective wealth, I think, soar by $200 billion, which is just astounding. But at the same time, you've got folks, obviously, you know, out of work, unemployed, you know, frankly, being killed because of COVID or losing their loved ones. And so I think, you know, what you're seeing is the whole system that was set up, you know, system of government, the system of our institutions, you know, it is It has collapsed them under the weight of these challenges, not being supported in order to address these huge challenges, and it's on the brink of collapse. And what I believe we need, and you know, is we need to really rebalance this so that systems can deliver for people. And one of the ways I think we need to rebalance it and address economic inequality is frankly through, you know, addressing the question of who is going to fund a lot of the solutions to the challenges and the crisis we face. And certainly we believe at Global Citizen that the wealthiest in our society who have seen their wealth skyrocket, we believe that they should be paying more, because it is astounding that despite their record growth, philanthropy is actually not as high as one would think. And so we would like to see that increase. We would like to see, you know, the world's billionaires give at least 5% of their wealth away in order to address their challenges. But it's a huge, multifaceted challenge we're seeing right now.
Amit, don't you feel that this disparity has actually increased during COVID-19 pandemic? Because the people who were wealthy, they have actually become wealthier. And people who were living in marginalized societies, they are actually, you know, going back to poverty.
Yeah, it's astounding. You know, I think one of the best people who have summed it up is David Beasley, the head of the World Food Program, who, of course, recently they were awarded with the Nobel Peace Prize. But he was addressing the UN Security Council, I think, back in September. And he said, look, when I heard that these billionaires had seen their wealth increase by hundreds of billions of dollars, you know, I'm like, well, that's great. I'm not opposed to anyone making money. But at the same time, the number of people going hungry is set to double, which sound like sometimes these figures, they sound so abstract. But when you're talking about hunger, you know, people that can't even put a meal on their table and feed their children, their families, themselves, and that number is set to double, you know, the acute hunger. And his point was, all I need is a few billion in order to avoid this crisis. That's all I need right now. That's all I'm asking for, and it could make the world of difference. You know, it really is quite extraordinary. So yeah, no, I think it has gotten worse. I hope, you know, there's been talks around, you know, what might be able to happen, you know, over the next 12 months. I hope we might be able to turn the corner. You know, I hope governments might understand that, okay, if we're going to have a social contract for all of our citizens, and all of our citizens around the world collectively, you know, we've got to be able to fund it. And so, you know, you do see some areas like Australia, which for many years had gutted its aid program, you know, they've increased their aid this year by over $1 billion to assist, you know, their neighbors in the Pacific and in small island developing countries. You know, you do see some glimpses of philanthropy, some folks contributing more, you know, and you see some countries and some companies in our society stepping up. But I think it remains the exception to the rule. And I think, you know, we're going to really have to push, you know, our institutions and our society, governments, philanthropists and corporations over the next 6 months if we're to try and not just reverse the progress, but actually get back on track to achieve the sustainable development goals. I mean, just one example, you know, there's been a lot of speculation about, you know, getting access to a vaccine. And in my view, perhaps one of the most manifest forms of inequality is the fact that more than half of the vaccines that are expected to be available over the coming year, half of those vaccines have all been pre-purchased by the wealthiest countries in our society, right? And so you're talking about a few countries have purchased like billions of doses of vaccines. And my view is, look, we can't get back to normal. No one is safe until everyone is safe. So we should really be investing in making sure that a vaccine, you know, is available to everyone everywhere who needs it, especially health workers, priority populations. And to me, you know, if we talk about inequality, well, perhaps the first sign that we can actually turn the page and show that we're committed to a more equitable world would be to actually invest and make sure that health workers, vulnerable populations everywhere are able to access these vaccines and that they're not hoarded by the wealthiest countries. Because otherwise, my fear, if we don't do that, is these inequalities will get worse, because what will happen is half the world will get access to vaccines and they will go back on their merry way, and the rest of the world will be left behind and forgotten, and they'll be dealing with COVID-19 and its after effects for the next few years.
You know, I was actually going through one of the latest reports by Oxford University and UNDP about MPI, and what little I could understand about MPI is the 10 data points or indicators that they have captured under three dimensions. And it made me realize that, you know, when we talk about inequalities, then we only consider few broader points, including poverty. But, you know, we need to understand is that if we have to achieve SDGs, including climate change, or you rightly, you know, put it across about people recovering from COVID-19 and the vaccine should be available for the marginalized society as well, then the first step, you know, has to be to eradicate inequalities, including poverty. But one thing, Talia, that I want to understand from you is that what role does education play in the entire ballgame if we talk about reducing inequality?
So education is foundational to providing children with the access to future opportunities. And that's everything from soft skills to being able to maneuver the world and feeling confident in interacting with other people, to harder skills like STEM, you know, and the sciences, and really providing children with hope in addition to those skills. You know, a lot of the children that we support through our campaigning at Global Citizen are the most marginalized kids around the world. They're children who are enduring conflict and crisis. You know, they're in northern Nigeria, where Boko Haram is keeping girls from accessing the right to learn, or children who are affected by the consequences we're already seeing because of climate change, right? Hurricanes, cyclones. And the, you know, consequences of those extreme weather events, you know, migration, children in refugee camps who, you know, have lost everything. And education is what provides them hope, right? So, you know, and for these children, usually when they're thrust into these scenarios, education is the first thing to be disrupted and the last to be resumed, because oftentimes, you know, the other very crucial, you know, elements of supporting a child's ability to, you know, be healthy and have access to nutrition and clean water are absolutely vital. But so is education. It not only provides them, you know, therefore with, you know, the opportunities to become, you know, the future scientists and support themselves, but also provides them with hope. And also in the shorter term, I would say, you know, education is the best tool to prevent a child from, you know, exposure to child marriage or child labor. And that's something that we're seeing is a big consequence of COVID-19 and massive fear that, you know, us working in global education are thinking a lot about and trying to stop. You know, as we see school closures around the world, over 1.5 billion kids around the world were affected by school closures. It's the most marginalized kids who are most likely to not return. And that's very much because of, you know, economic strains and parents being, you know, in a position where they put their child into a working environment or early marriage again. So, you know, it's really crucial to, you know, in the short term and longer term for, you know, allowing children to have opportunity and help.
You know, I was actually going through UNICEF statistics and I actually found that every day almost 22,000 children die due to poverty. And that kind of shook me to the core. How do you see poverty as a threat for our upcoming generations? And I'm not just talking about generations which are living in poverty. I'm also talking about people who proclaim themselves to be billionaire or millionaires. Even they will be affected if, you know, this inequality will increase.
Yeah. So, and something I should have mentioned before, you know, is the, of course, you know, multiplying effects that we see for everyone when a child is able to not only access an education, but a quality and inclusive education, and make sure that we're leaving no child behind, whether that's a child with disabilities, a child who identifies as LGBTQ, and making sure that, you know, they have the resources to learn, right? And not only go to school, but really learn once they're in school. And, you know, the multiplying effects, whether that's security and supporting the child to, you know, be able to avoid recruitment from, you know, armed, you know, militia, or, you know, supporting our future workforces. And so the multiplying effects are absolutely massive. And, you know, there's a interesting stat from Brookings Institute, that for every $1 spent on education, it yields $10 to $15 in economic growth over a person's lifetime in the form of higher earnings and wages. Improving literacy and is an important way to lift people out of poverty, right? And so that is, of course, incredibly important to supporting our, you know, of course, broader economic stability, which leads into security.
Yeah, I would just add to that that, you know, it's a good question, right? And I think often when we promote education and why it's important to invest, it's exactly because the reason is that actually we're going to get to a point where economies are going to founder if you don't invest now in the potential of your young people. And, you know, I just remember a few years ago, this report came out, it was by an education commission with a number of these luminaries on. Julia Gillard, the former Prime Minister of Australia, was amongst them. But they really laid out the case of how, look, if you don't invest and if you effectively have a lost generation of young people, this will eventually stunt economic growth because of the fact that already in some parts of the world, you know, employers actually can't find the people with the right skills they need to do the jobs in order to grow their businesses and expand. And I think if you look at parts of, say, Africa in particular, you look at South Africa, right, and you look at its human development index, you know, this is a country which on the one hand is amongst one of the wealthiest economies in Africa, but actually when you look at, you know, dive down, a quarter of its population live in extreme poverty. In terms of the quality of some of its education levels, it's actually a lot less even than some of its neighbors. And I think the challenge here is unless a country like South Africa really invests in the education, you know, and addresses the challenges that might go into getting a quality education, even basic things such as nutrition, right? Having a basic meal at school can do so much to help a child's cognitive ability to learn, overcome stunting and just grasp more and not be pushed further behind. But eventually, you know, if we don't invest in this, you're going to end up in a scenario where, as traditionally, you know, manufacturing jobs, you know, the types of jobs that say 2-3 decades ago helped countries, you know, lift themselves out of poverty and lift their communities out of poverty because of automation, because of the technological revolution, you know, those jobs and that form of export-driven manufacturing job isn't going to be available to many countries, that model isn't going to be there that they can emulate to lift their societies out of poverty. Therefore, for them to compete, and those jobs are out there, like the employers are saying, like, we want to find people with the right skills, but they've got to invest in the quality of their education. And this is something which, you know, it will be an issue for economic growth long term. I mean, once we get through the pandemic, and of course, the pandemic itself has just exposed, you know, the challenges in ensuring quality of education. And again, it all comes back to inequality, equity. You know, if you're out of school, you know, you take these 1.5 billion children out of school. I think there are some stats that suggest that, you know, in some places, 1 in 3 households didn't have access to internet. And therefore, how can you learn remotely if you don't have access to the internet in the modern age? And so, you know, this is certainly the case we've been making, you know, not just to government, but to businesses, to philanthropists, that this is something which they ought to invest in. And we've seen some examples of businesses taking this on. You know, Cisco, I remember being in Nigeria with them. They're obviously one of our partners, and looking at these digital academies that they were running in outside Lagos, and looking at the potential of that to you know, really train people with the skills in the digital economy that they might need to compete. But a lot more needs to be done. And you can see the World Bank's just released its latest human capital index, and it really shows, you know, the depth of inequity when it comes to basic essentials such as education. And, you know, it's a tragedy, and it will be a tragedy for these young people, and it will be a tragedy for the world if we don't fix this.
But, you know, Mick, don't you feel that this is an opportunity for businesses as well? Because when we talk about the rapidly changing economy, and when we know that 5 years down the line, the job that we have today may even go obsolete. And anyhow, the businesses needs to empower right skill set to the people, to the future workforce. Then why don't they, you know, come ahead and maybe kind of empower the same skill set to the marginalized society as well?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's true. Like, I think Cisco, if you look at them, for example, you know, they obviously see Africa as a growth market for them. And I think part of the reason why they're investing in these digital academies, I mean, yeah, it's partly altruistic. They want to do the right thing. But they also recognize that, look, if this is going to be a market, we need people with the skills so that we can grow our business. And therefore, we need to be able to invest in providing these skills. And I think you see other examples of that from technology companies. But really, to a certain extent, you know, that will do wonders for the kids that are able to enroll in the program. But in order to reach kids everywhere and in the most remote, vulnerable communities, ultimately, that's the responsibility of government. It's government that has the social contract with their people. And it's governments that need to be able to deliver those services and ensure no children is left behind. And what we're seeing at the moment is governments, just for one reason or another, just don't have the revenues often in order to invest in these systems. And often it's a struggle because you're trying to deal with the current issues now, right? To create revenue, you know, provide now, and the payoffs of education is down the line, right? You may not see it for a further decade. So often the incentives, the long term versus the short term. But even if you look at the moment, you know, one big issue facing many of these governments is the crushing debt, which has been really exacerbated by the current pandemic. You know, you look at the current pandemic, right? And you look at the G20 countries, they've been able to inject like $11 trillion in terms of stimulating their economies. And many of these measures have had unemployment benefits, cash transfers, you know, for kids out of school, it's had benefits to ensure that they don't get left behind. You know, a whole range of social protection measures have been embedded in many of these measures, right? And I think if you, again, take the G20, the amount that they've been able to invest and stimulate in their economies is over 20% of their GDP, right? You go to some of the poorest nations, right? Now, their economies are obviously much smaller, and they've only been able to invest 3% of their GDP. Again, 3% of a much smaller pie in stimulating their economy and providing social protection measures. And you have a ridiculous scenario where some of these countries are having to pay interest on debt, right? And that is money which they could otherwise be putting into meeting essential needs right now, like health and education, but they're not able to do that because they're worried if they don't pay off their debt and they default, what's that going to mean for their marketability in the next few years and their ability to get loans and credit? They don't want to be locked off from the financial market system. And so it's my view, and it's telling we're having this interview the day before or the same weekend as the G20 summit, right? That's being hosted by Saudi Arabia. But this is why, you know, the world's institutions need to come together, you know, governments, the private sector, and they need to look seriously at debt relief and debt restructure. It's great that they've suspended some forms of government debt. The private sector haven't, by the way. They've done next to zero on this spike cause for them to do so. But government have. They've suspended repayments on debt for at least a year. But we need to go further. And I think seriously, we need to look at cancellations, because unless we can do that, these governments aren't going to have the resources to be able to invest in essential services like education. So yes, I agree with you. The private sector have a role to play. Many of them are looking to do that. You know, we've seen Verizon, you know, they invested, you know, in Education Cannot Wait, which is a great organization we work with to ensure that children out of school due to crisis are able to have some form of education. But really, we need to address the structural inequalities, right, facing governments around the world, and ultimately governments are the system set up to deliver for people, and they're not able to do that because whether it's debt or other reasons or tax avoidance or other structural issues, they're simply not able to have the resources to invest in their people.
Mick, don't you believe that poverty or inequality is not a country-specific issue? I believe that this is the biggest threat to human race. And especially, you know, when we have statistics like that, we know that 132 million of the global poor live in areas with high flood risk. And it's not just about living in high flood risk area. It is also about understanding that people living in poverty are prone to threats that are, you know, so-called society cannot even
look,
see.
I agree with you. I mean, I think this is an issue which is not just between countries, but within countries. And even in America, you know, what you saw with COVID was that I think there were some stats, and Talia knows this far better than I do, but I think one in three African-American households in America didn't have access to internet. And so when their kids were out of school, and by the way, as we're talking, New York yesterday went into semi-lockdown and schools were closed again. And when that happens, I think, well, gee, you know, what about those kids who are in households without access to internet? How are they going to get a proper education, right? And so this is an issue everywhere. But again, you know, whether it's in America, whether it's in a country like South Africa, you know, again, the systems that have been set up to deliver for people aren't delivering. And so we need to look at that. And this is where COVID-19 might be an opportunity to actually, if we can get it right, it might be an opportunity to recover better together. And what I mean by that is, okay, well, if we can look at a few examples, like I mentioned before, the access to a vaccine, right? If we can get countries to come together and fund the notion that everyone everywhere should get an access to a vaccine, because unless we do that, no one will be safe everywhere. There will be no going back to normal, no international trade, no international flights until every country, you know, has access to this. You know, I think if we can do that, you know, maybe that will be a blueprint that comes out of this crisis for how countries can work together, right, to address inequities and ensure that everyone has access to essential basic services. And maybe this blueprint can be used in healthcare, can be used in education in order to do that. You know, I'm a firm believer, you know, I'm an optimist, right? So I'm a firm believer in the capacity of humanity to overcome adversity and recover better. And you know, while you might have one step back, ultimately it ends up being two steps forward. You know, and I think if you go back 75 years ago, this is obviously the 75th anniversary since the founding of the United Nations out of from the ashes of the Second World War. You know, it's true that often crises are remembered for as much as how they end, right, for how they begin. And I think maybe there is the capacity, right, if we can get this right in how we end the pandemic, right, and ensure no one gets left behind, maybe when the history is written about 2020 and subsequent years of this pandemic, maybe they will write of how the world actually did come together, right, because they recognized it was in their collective interest to ensure that the pandemic was ended for everyone and not just a few, because if it was only ended for a few, ultimately that was going to be detrimental to everyone's interest if we can't all recover at the same time.
Absolutely. And one thing which you have rightly pointed out, and which I also believe, that poverty is not just about financial disparity. It is also about understanding that majority of the poverty-related issues are either color, caste, creed, or gender-based issues. Talia, what do you have to say about this, and how do you see it?
Yeah, you know, before the pandemic, 258 million kids around the world were out of school, and 130 million of those were girls. You know, meanwhile, 90% of the kids with disabilities worldwide were out of school, and 80% of those kids with disabilities were in developing countries. And so there's a lot of work to be done to make sure that, you know, like I mentioned before, that we're not only, you know, putting in really important efforts to support kids getting into school, and you know, for the more vulnerable groups like girls, that could include extra security, that includes, you know, contextualized measures to make sure that they're able to access the resources they need in order to actually go to school. But once they're in school, there's a ton of resources that they're also going to need, you know, from teacher training for kids with disabilities to the right type of curriculum, you know, in these days during COVID-19, but it's not going to end after COVID-19 with remote learning. The right type of curriculum and making sure that teachers and caregivers are trained and well-resourced to support the most vulnerable kids with unique needs, or not so unique needs, but children that are often left behind, is absolutely fundamental to you know, making sure that we do have equitable access to education for everyone.
You know, I'm still in shock after going through some of these statistics in the last few days. But can you throw some light on what should be our way forward if we have to eradicate poverty from our society?
Yeah, I mean, first and foremost, I think we need governments, you know, like Nick mentioned, to deliver on their promises to their people, whether that's governments in developing countries, you know, fulfilling promises made for expenditures, for resources, for, you know, vital social services and vital resources for people living in poverty, from, you know, of course, access to education, to, you know, quality food and nutrition, supporting smallholder farmers, of course, health resources as a human right. We need donor countries to, you know, deliver on ensuring at least 0.7% of their GNI goes to social development assistance, making sure that that's dispersed to you know, the needs of people abroad. Like 15% of that does need to go to education. Like Mick said, we need governments to step up to, you know, address the burden of debt in developing countries. And we need philanthropists to, you know, give to support critical initiatives. We need a private sector to support critical initiatives. And that's not only financial. You know, that can also be through really innovative, creative solutions. Our partner Education Cannot Wait, that Mick mentioned earlier, does incredibly unique, innovative, and fast-acting and impactful work with the private sector to co-create solutions for kids around the world. So, you know, there's a lot to do and everyone has a role to play. And of course, to get that done, you know, people are calling on their governments. And I think, you know, people continuing that call to action for governments to step up. The resources are there. We need the will. And so we can get there.
So just to piggyback off that, you know, we actually have the blueprint for ending extreme poverty. It's called the Sustainable Development Goals, and all countries signed up to this 5 years ago. And, you know, within that, it is actually the blueprint for how you address all of these issues, equitable access to education, you know, making sure that health systems are able to withstand pandemics and shocks like what we've just seen. And you know what, the SDGs, I mean, there's a lot there, but in order to achieve them, you know, pre-pandemic, it's probably a little bit more now, but pre-pandemic, you know, it was estimated that it would cost an additional $350 billion per year for the next 10 years in the world's poorest nations if we were to achieve the SDGs and thus end extreme poverty in those countries. Now, $350 billion sounds like a lot. But when you put it in perspective, it's less than half of what the United States spends on its military each year, right? But the payoffs in terms of enhanced prosperity, stability, you know, would be profound. So yes, I'm not diminishing that it may be a lot, but compared to other forms of expenditure, as Talia said, if every country lived up to their obligation to give 0.7% of their gross national income in development assistance, that's the wealthiest nations, that is, that alone would be almost $350 billion a year. So it's really a question of political will. It's nothing more than that. It is the determination and desire of our leaders to get this done. And just to give you, you know, an example of where the political will is lacking, you know, this week there's been reports that the United Kingdom government, right? The government of the, there's been reports that the government of the United Kingdom, now the UK up until this point been one of the most generous nations in the world, one of the few countries that actually meets that 0.7%. But there's been reports this week that next week they might actually announce cuts to this figure, right? Which could be billions of dollars ripped from the budget that's meant to provide, you know, services for the most vulnerable people around the world. And part of the reason why they might do that is because of, you know, economic recession, pressures from COVID, etc. But now this is where it gets to a question of priorities and political will. Just in the last 24 hours, the Boris Johnson government has announced, I think, £16 billion increase in the defense budget, something crazy. And that £16 billion increase is more than the entire British aid budget combined, right? And so when you stack that up against one another, you know, and bearing in mind that it's these aid dollars that isn't just having an impact on the most vulnerable societies, but by ending the pandemic for everyone, making sure vaccines are available for all, you know, investing in health systems so that they can address the pandemic so it doesn't linger on. You know, these are investments which is going to have an impact for people, you know, back in the UK over time. You know, when you look at that and you look, okay, money invested into military going up, money invested into aid going down, and we've seen this in other countries in recent years, including my own country of Australia, you know, it really is profound. So it's a question of political will to get this down. However, what I would say is alongside government action, right, we also need to look at the wealthiest in our society, and we need to appeal to them to also chip in, because we've seen in this year alone that how linked global health and global development and economic health is, right? So again, it would be in their interest to underscore and invest in this. And I ultimately believe that, you know, if we can figure out a way, you know, to fund the SDGs, right, over the next 12 months, next 18 months, if we can figure out a way to meet the essential needs, then it's possible still to get on track to achieve, you know, our vision of a world without extreme poverty. But it is going to require fundamental changes in terms of how we think about global development. And I think through this pandemic, you know, maybe is an opportunity to, you know, we often see global development through the prism of rich countries versus poor countries. Maybe we need to reframe that and think about global development in general, right? All countries are on a spectrum, like we've seen that in the United States. And if we can reframe that in general, then we can basically make the argument that there should be a universal basic social contract that applies to all citizens around the world, not just those in our national borders. And through that, you know, governments ought to be funding this, and so should the wealthiest in our society too. And you know, we've launched a voluntary appeal to the world's billionaires. But I think the fact remains that if you look at in America, for instance, and you look at the wealth of the 400 top Americans, you know, and you look at their so-called giving and philanthropy, the fact remains that so much of money that is allegedly being given or donated for philanthropic purposes, so much of that is just sat in foundations and donor-advised funds accumulating interest. And there ought to be measures in place to prevent that. There ought to be measures in place that forces those funds to spend down, because it is just tragic that billions is sat accumulated interest when that could be put to work right now, ending the pandemic for everyone, avoiding the hunger crisis, resuming education for all, rebooting action on climate, and ensuring the most vulnerable don't get left behind. And so some of these regulatory measures are some of the things we're going to be looking at for our Give While You Live campaign over the coming year or so.
You know, this is my personal belief. I may be wrong, and correct me if I'm wrong. I believe that why governments are paying least attention on reducing inequalities is because when we talk about 17 goals, I'm sorry, you know, they have kind of bifurcated their entire budget on the different sustainable goals. But what I believe is that if they will invest on reducing inequalities, then majority of the goals that we have will by default be...
I think there is some logic in that argument, certainly from our perspective. You know, while we believe that the Sustainable Development Goals are ultimately critical to ending extreme poverty, in the meantime, it's our view that over the next 12 months, we need to focus on meeting essential needs so that we can recover better together and have the most impact in people's lives. And in doing that, you're exactly right. You know, we will ultimately shorten the long road it will take to achieve the Sustainable Development Goals. And so we've, rather than focusing on all 17 goals, we've launched a 5-point recovery plan for people on planet to recover better together. And the 5 key elements of this plan is, first, to end the pandemic by making sure vaccines are available to everyone. Secondly, to invest in avoiding a hunger crisis from spiraling into a hunger pandemic. Thirdly, it is to resume education for all and not just those that can afford remote learning. Fourthly, it is to reboot action on the climate next year in the lead up to the COP. And fifthly, it really is to make sure we don't leave the most marginalized and vulnerable behind, and to make sure that companies, philanthropists, foundations are investing in those organizations that are addressing gender, racial, and other critical disparities that we see. And so, you know, that's our 5-point plan. And we're trying to marshal as much support from government, the private sector, and corporations towards achieving that over the coming year.
You know, when we talk about reducing inequalities, or even if we talk about sustainable development goals, we always talk about how billionaires or the, you know, rich society can pump in money, or how governments can support. But I believe that this is the responsibility of each and individual. It is your responsibility and it is my responsibility to work towards reducing inequalities. How do you see we as people can work towards reducing inequality?
Yeah, I mean, it's in our name, right? Global citizen, because we ultimately believe the citizen is the ultimate agent of change. And we were founded on the premise that no amount of gala night charity dinners is going to end extreme poverty, right? And we believe that actually, when you look at the reasons why people live in poverty, it's because of structural systemic injustices. And the only way you're going to achieve an end or remedy to those injustices is through a social movement, a movement of people. And when you look at history, the civil rights movement, the end of apartheid, you know, even going back to the end of the transatlantic slave trade 200 years ago, it's always been driven by a concerted group of people that combine to form a powerful movement of citizens, you know, both in one country, but often in solidarity with other activists in other countries around the world. And so from our perspective at Global Citizen, it's really been our mission to catalyze and nurture that movement to end extreme poverty, and to educate, empower, and engage, and give them a platform to take action. Ultimately, you know, we can't blame the politicians always. We have to give them permission to spend what is in the end our money. And the best way to do that is to use our voice. And so at Global Citizen, we, for our platform, we've provided a way for people to email, to call, to use social media, but ultimately to petition their leaders and elected officials to hold them accountable to the promises they made to end extreme poverty.
You know, what, according to you, should be the way forward when we talk about our policies? Because we understand that there is a complete disconnect between countries when we talk about, you know, such issues. Yes, we have been following the same guidelines set by United Nations, but this is not a group work or a collaborative work that we can see from the country side. So what do you think? What policy should we create in order to make it a collaborative movement instead of independently working towards it?
I think, you know, we can use a few examples, right? And let's concentrate on the issue of tax evasion. So often, you know, a friend of mine, Hassan, he wrote a book called The Responsible Globalist that came out about a year ago. And in that book, he looks at the issue of tax evasion, right? And he says it's ironic because in many parts of the world, right, part of the reason why there's been an erosion of trust in international institutions like the UN and other bodies, presumably also the WHO, you know, whilst there's been a decline of trust in those institutions, often that decline of trust comes from a perception that it is people, the middle class, and say a small number of countries, let's call it the industrialized West, that are being asked to pay and underwrite, you know, the cost of those institutions, right? And they feel that they shouldn't be the only ones paying for that, right? At the same time, they look in their backyards, they look in their communities, and they say, look, we've got services here that aren't being met. And again, this has been really brought to light through COVID, right? The irony in that is part of the reason why these institutions are ill-equipped or incapable of meeting these needs is because they're not funded. And part of the reason why they're not funded is because, you know, governments don't have the tax revenues in order to fund them, right? And the reason why it's ironic is the very institutions that, you know, have had trust in them eroded because, you know, they don't deliver for people, and people are like, why should my taxpayers' money be going to these institutions if they add no value to me? But the irony is exactly these sorts of institutions, a global-minded approach, which could actually close loopholes in tax havens around the world, right? So you look at the fact that at the moment, you know, our ability to tax the wealthiest corporations, individuals, you know, really isn't possible because they can just move their money offshore to different havens, you know, around the world. And it's only going to be a globally coordinated approach that would close those havens and allow actually them all to be properly taxed. And then in doing so, would actually deliver the money needed, not just to meet essential services back home, but also to fund these global institutions set up to address these challenges. So often we point our fury when systems that are meant to deliver for people, we point our fury at the wrong places, recognizing that actually the symptoms of that fury, you know, these institutions could be part of the very key to addressing that, like the case of tax evasion, right? Which, you know, even just changing that could unlock hundreds of billions for both domestic services and international development.
But, you know, Talia, how, according to you, we can use our existing education system in order to prepare our present and future generations on this subject, and how we can involve them in this fight?
Yeah, you know, we're seeing really incredible work being done by organizations around the world to make sure that their curriculum reinforce the importance of, you know, supporting a clean environment and protecting our planet and nature, to global citizenship we're seeing around the world, and education about sustainable development goals. And we're seeing more and more of that, which is incredibly, not only exciting, but obviously incredibly important, you know, to Mick's point about, you know, what's the best tool to get our governments to, you know, bring about that political will, because we know that they can do it. We just need them to act, right, boldly and urgently. And so supporting kids at a young age to feel empowered, you know, a lot of these issues can be very overwhelming. You know, climate change, which has an enormous impact on education, on all the issues on food and nutrition, on employment and livelihoods of people around the world living, especially in poverty, who rely on their environment, not only for their livelihoods, but also for their culture. You know, and so you know, empowering young people to feel confident, to call on the world leaders, hold them accountable, to deliver for their countries, but like what Mick was saying, for the whole world, is absolutely a massive piece of it.
And I think I was just going to add on that just related to what Talia was saying, she makes an important point that education itself can actually be the answer to embed in this notion of global citizenship in citizens, and ultimately over time building an educated, empowered, and engaged citizenry that actually believes that their government should be doing this, understanding that these are issues that tackle all of us, and we should be addressing them as global citizens. And I think that's why, you know, in the Sustainable Development Goals and the fourth goal on education, you know, I think it was 4.7 that specifically called on countries, you know, as they were investing in education, to also look at how they embed global citizenship in their curriculums. And, you know, whether it's climate change, whether it's inequalities, whether it's frankly even the racial injustice of many countries in the world, but making sure that that is in systems so that over time, citizens, when they grow up, or the young people, when they grow up, you know, they actually have this context for the world we live in. It's very critical. And, you know, it's had a lot of support. You know, Ban Ki-moon, the former UN Secretary General, you know, he's made this one of his, I guess, key issues out of office. But it probably doesn't get as much attention as it deserves. I fear it's often seen as one of those warm and fluffy things, you know, against STEM and all of the other critical issues we study at school. But actually, it could have profound implications over the coming years and coming generations for our ability to address many of the challenges which we're going to see, such as climate change and other existential threats. Also inequality over the coming decade.
Mick, you know, what should I say? You actually stole my words. This is exactly what I was going to say.
Great minds think alike, I guess.
And with this, it's time to say goodbye to you both. It was a pleasure having you on the show, Mick and Talia.
Oh, just wanted to thank you so much for having us on the show. It was really great to speak with you today.
I hope that you all have enjoyed listening to this fun and meaningful conversation with Mick and Talia. And if you have liked this conversation, then do rate us on Apple Podcasts and share it with your network. And we will meet again in the next episode with another amazing guest.
Thank you for listening to The Edge Show. You can now listen to the same podcast on Apple and Google Podcasts, or you can watch it live on YouTube. And I'll see you in the next episode. Till then, stay safe and stay happy.